This is a beginning of a series of workshops that the counseling department would like to offer leaders. Insights from counselors about ways to maybe enhance your leadership. And this is the first of that series. Our topic today is focused on listening. This is, listening is a skill set that really needs to be developed by leaders. For a lot of reasons. I think the title slide kind of indicates what some of those reasons are. You know, we listen to understand, and we listen in order to love, because people feel loved when they're heard. And we listen in order to influence others, and we listen to be influenced by others. And lastly, we listen in order to be heard. One of the most effective ways to be heard is to first hear, and hear the other person and hear what they're thinking. Well, let's go ahead and get started. I'd like to start really with an exercise. So if you take out that little handout packet you got a series of handouts. One of them is called Exercises. Take a look at Exercise 1. It's just a pencil and paper exercise where I'd like you to sort of evaluate your listening. All right, so go ahead and take that, and we'll start when you finish. Well, how did that go for you? How did that turn out? Hopefully, it stimulated you to listen about listening. All right, let's just say a couple of things before we get into the meat of this today. One thing I notice about God in the Bible is that he asks questions and he listens. God says, "Speak to me." He says, ask me for things. He knows everything. If that's the case, why would he ask us questions? Why would he tell us to speak with him? Why would he tell us to ask him things? You ever had that question put to you? Have you ever had that question yourself? Like, why pray if God knows everything? It must be, since he's not asking for information, it must be that we need to talk. That there's something valuable for us. When he says to Adam, where are you? There's something Adam needs to do with God. When he says to Cain, where's your brother? There's something Cain needs to do in his interaction with God. When God says, praise me, there's something that's going to happen to us because we've praised God. When he tells us to ask him for things, there must be something that's going to happen for us. That he asks us to ask him for things. And so part of one reason we listen is, like God, we know that the person we're with needs to talk. It's important for them. It's not just important for us. Another reason to listen too, though, is that God, again, asks us to interact with him. He built us to be relational. He intends for us to relate to one another. It must be that when he asks us to ask for things, when he calls on us to say things, when he asks us questions and waits for us to respond, it must be that because we're built to be relational, we operate best when we're relating. Otherwise, we wouldn't need anyone to listen to us. We wouldn't need a person to listen to us. We could just simply talk to ourselves. And then people wouldn't have problems in situations like solitary confinement. We're built to be relational. And so one important reason for listening is the person in front of you is built to work best when they're relating to another person like you. Of course, there are additional reasons why we, who are not omniscient and are not holy and are not righteous, why we need to ask questions. We know very little. We need information. We need to listen long enough that we begin having a sense of why someone's doing what they're doing and feel with them. Empathy is to feel with someone. Sympathy is to feel for them. But when you empathize, you listen long enough that you can actually imagine being in their situation, and you're feeling many feelings that they were feeling. Maybe not exactly the same, but similar feelings. Empathy. We listen to empathize. We listen in order to let ourselves be influenced by the one we're listening to. And to diminish the confusion that develops when two people are trying to be heard at the same time. And so there's a lot of reasons to listen. Of course, another reason to listen is unity. You know, all of us who lead understand the beauty of a group of people who are unified in one purpose, who've somehow taken the Great Commission of God and seen how it fits into their situation, and the whole group agrees with that. There's this great unity there. We like that kind of unity. We also like the unity that comes through grace. You know, through grace, we accept one another. Through grace, we forgive one another. Through grace, we forbear with things that just aren't going to change very quickly. But an important part of fostering unity, beyond mission and beyond grace, is fostering an ethos of attentiveness to other people, to what they're experiencing, to what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they want, what they're doing. And an important part of leadership then is to cultivate this environment of listeners, attentive people. And finally, another reason to listen is that if you hate entering into conflict, the easiest door to walk through when you have to enter conflict is the door of let me hear you out, listening. If I make it easy for the other person to talk, I can enter into conflict, and it's not such a mess. Conflicts are always a mess when someone's attacking and someone's defending. Conflicts are less of a mess even if someone's attacking, if the other person is not defending but listening. Also, if you tend to find yourself embroiled in conflicts and you cannot find your way out of a lot of conflicts, they seem to go on and on, often listening is the most rapid way to get out of a conflict as well. Well, these are all various reasons to listen. We could talk more about this, but I wanted to get practical today. But one more thing, I guess, before I get real practical is the importance, as a listener, the importance of you personally taking a humble stance. You can't listen if you know everything or think you know everything. You can't listen if you believe what you've observed is the only thing, is the most accurate thing that's observed. You can't listen if you think you already know what the answers are. It's super important for a listener to take the posture of humility, that our confidence and our ability to observe and to discern and to remember things may be misplaced. A lot of research, and I think even the Bible, makes it pretty clear that we're very subjective and we're prone to errors in observation, in memory formation, in memory recall, in logic, that we're prone to errors. And the posture a real listener, not a fake listener, but a real listener has to take is the posture of, there's much I don't know here. And there's much about my own perceptions I can't entirely trust. And so by making it easy for a person to talk, I am learning at least how the world looks from their perspective. And I'm getting maybe perceptions I had corrected even as I'm listening. It's important to be humble. I mean, the Bible certainly makes this clear when it talks about the flesh. The heart is what? It's deceitful and desperately sick. Who can know it? Jeremiah 17:9. This is a biblical revelation that's becoming increasingly clear to secular researchers as well. I don't know if you've read the book, but you should really look up the book sometime by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. Elliot Aronson's the guy who did the famous prisoner guard experiment that got out of hand, where the students who were the guards in the experiment became really quite sadistic toward the prisoners in the experiment. And it took him years to admit that he let it get out of hand. And that story is part of the story in the book, the difficulty of having an accurate view of what's going on around you. The point they make in the book, and this is a completely secular book, is that human beings are so prone to self-deception and self-justification that they have to take a humble posture if they're going to know anything at all. And they give tons of examples from their lives and other people's lives, but the point that they make is that they have this, the model they have in mind is that human beings have a certain perception of themselves. And for most people, it's a fairly positive perception. But then human beings have these behaviors that maybe don't line up with their self-perception. And when there's a discrepancy in their model between how I perceive myself and what I've done, that my brain will immediately and automatically make up a story that will reconcile this sense of myself over against my behavior in a way that favors me. Meaning, we will self-justify and self-deceive within milliseconds. So you've seen this happen on the road, where maybe you make a mistake. You generally think that you're a decent driver, but you make a mistake, and someone honks their horn or flips you off, and immediately you're generating a story how they're at fault and you're not. You see this with kids, of course. You see it even amongst adults when someone says, "I can't believe you did that," and you say, "But they did that other thing first," right? We immediately have these stories that we make up that help us to feel justified. And so, you know, both scripture and secular researchers show that human beings are hopelessly self-justifying and self-deceiving. And that means, of course, that I am hopelessly self-justifying and self-deceiving. I have to take a humble posture, especially in conflict with someone. I have to take the humble posture that my story may not line up with reality, and even though it seems true to me. Humility. Because we're fallen, we have to take a humble posture. The interesting thing about this book, as secular as it is just, they're really left with something that looks like humility and repentance as the only way around the blindness we can walk into. But also, you know, we need to be humble. In order to be a good listener, we need to be humble, not just because of how our flesh is, but just what is known about how the human brain works. We know more now about how the brain works than ever before, and the more we learn, the more we realize that there's a part of the brain that generates stories that may or may not be true, but are almost always self-serving. And, you know, our perception, the way our brains perceive things, is not accurate. We don't record accurately everything. Human beings focus their attention on some things and they ignore others. If you were autistic, you might have trouble suppressing all this, the information that's coming in a situation. Everything may have equal weight, but most normal people, when they enter into a situation, they only attend to certain things and they ignore other things. Right? When you look at that show, the detective show Monk, you know, what was it about this guy? For all of his problems, he was at some level kind of autistic. He could not stop noticing every single thing. And his trouble was being able to sort through everything and sort of consciously try to narrow it down to what mattered most. A lot of the Sherlock Holmes stories are very similar. These are unusual people. These are stories, of course, not real, but they're often based on the fact that there are people who cannot selectively attend to some things and ignore others. But the problem, of course, with those of us who are normal is that we tend to notice some things and we tend to totally not notice others. Have you ever seen the movie The Invisible Gorilla? So this is a situation where two groups of people, one in light colors, one in dark colors, each group has a basketball. Each group is passing the basketball amongst their fellow dark-membered or light-membered people, and they're mingling together. So you got people that are mingling together in a room, and the white colors are passing to the white colors and the dark to the dark. One basketball each. And the audience is asked to notice how many times the light-colored team passes the ball. How many passes are there? And so as the film begins and people are counting the number of passes the white team makes, this person dressed in a gorilla suit walks right through the middle of the group and raises their hands in the air and shakes their fists at the camera and walks off, 50% of the audience does not see the gorilla, the invisible gorilla. I've got this naive scientist thing here because this is my own story of selective attention. In my case, I didn't have selective attention because I was naive. I studied spinal cord. I studied the development of the spinal cord as a graduate student. And one day I saw this gigantic nerve cell in the spinal cord of the species I was looking at. And I showed it to my fellow grad students and my advisors, and they were all chuckling. They said, "That's not a nerve cell, that's a capillary." And, you know, they had more experience than I had with nervous systems, and so they knew that something this big wasn't a nerve cell, right? I was naive because I didn't know what the range of nerve cells was in terms of size. This could have been a nerve cell to me. As I began looking at this thing that I thought was a nerve cell, and I sliced the tissue thin and I looked at it on an electron microscope, it turns out, in fact, this was a giant nerve cell. Was I brighter than everyone else in the lab? Absolutely not. I was more naive. They had selective attention. They had already decided what the range of normal-sized nerve cells was, and this was outside of that range, therefore this wasn't a nerve cell. This is just how the human brain works. Because I was naive, I didn't know what the outside range was, and therefore I thought it could be, and it turns out it was. I didn't have selective attention because I was naive. You see the same thing, if you Google Invisible Gorilla, you'll see also things about movie edits, where one person will hear a phone ring and they'll get up and they'll walk into another room and they'll get the phone. And a lot most people don't realize is the person who got up when the phone rang is not the same person who picks up the phone and talks. It feels to the audience like it's the same person, even though it's a different person wearing different clothing. And this is just selective attention. When we're under stress, we tend to attend to some things more than others, and so under stress, we often notice even fewer things. It's kind of stress blindness. In a fight, we tend to zoom in on some things and completely miss others. It's worse with those having a history of abuse because they may dissociate. They may emotionally detach from the room and not at all be aware of what's happening. So whether it's a normal person under stress or someone with who's come through a history of abuse as a kid, their ability to attend to what's going on could be even worse. And I've seen this in marriage counseling, in stressed relationships many times. It's this remarkable phenomenon where a couple will begin telling me about a fight, and the number of discrepancies between one person's account and the other are so many and so extreme, you would think that these two people were fighting with two different people in two different venues. You know, one will say, "We were in the backyard," and the other one's like, "No, we weren't. We were in the living room. You said this. I didn't say this. I said that. You never said that." And so they can go back and forth. And I've seen cases where I'm just astounded at how different the stories are. Even taking into account that some people lie, I don't think this is about lying most of the time. This is about selective attention. If we're going to be a listener, we've got to realize we're as vulnerable to selective attention as anybody, and we may have missed things. Also, you know, we've learned an awful lot about how memories are formed. Memories aren't stored in one place, they're stored in many places. Certain aspects of the memory are stored in one area, certain other aspects are stored in another. When memories are recalled, they're stitched together from these various sources, and new things are added to the memory. So that the memory I'm remembering is not exactly like the memory that was put in. And the memory that was put in, if we believe in selective attention, wasn't even an accurate memory to begin with. I'm not trying to say by this we can have no confidence in our memories. I'm trying to say by this we need to be humble about what we think we remember. It's easy to form a false memory. Easy. The police do it all the time, whether deliberately or accidentally. They will steer a witness as they're questioning the witness in such a way that the witness comes up with a memory that is sometimes not at all like the experience they had. This is especially true in single event memories. It's very easy to manipulate a single event memory in a way that leaves it inaccurate. And we already know that recalling memories very often human beings process memories in a way that's favorable to them. And so as I'm remembering a fight with my wife, I'm going to typically remember the fight in a way that is favorable to me and not to her. Even if I don't intend to, and if I believe I'm trying to be accurate, I will just make it look more favorable to me. Have to be humble if we're going to be good listeners. There's a tendency also to project, you know, things that we're dealing with, conflicts that we've had, past experiences that we've had. We often project onto situations so that our sense of what happened is really quite different than what actually happened. Projection. Seeing conflicts that aren't really present. We have to be humble. Good listeners are humble people. When they do functional studies of how the brain works, they can identify the parts of the brain that are involved in logic and verbal reasoning, and parts of the brain that are involved in empathy, and it turns out both of these circuits aren't on at the same time. Either the logical part is on or the empathetic part is on, or the empathetic part is on and the logical part is off. They're not on at the same time because we switch back and forth. If our bias is to try to be logical, we're going to come short on listening empathetically. If our bias is to be empathetic, we can't always trust we're thinking about what's being said in a logical way, just because our brains work this way. And finally, just to wrap this part up, I'm trying to appeal for humility. Good listeners are humble. I'm trying to provide evidence why you should be humble. And the last piece of evidence is that when decisions are made, a part of the prefrontal cortex, the orbital cortex, is used that is in fact heavily connected to emotional brain. If this area of the brain gets damaged, people cannot make decisions, even decisions about whether to eat or not. But this part of the brain is so connected to the emotional brain that we've come to realize that once someone makes a decision, there's a very emotional component to decision-making. Even if we think we're being logical, we're misunderstanding what's actually going on. All right. Well, I've probably said more than enough about this. The next area that I want to talk about before we get into listening proper is that when we're listening, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get an intimate look at what's going on inside of someone. But the person that we're listening to didn't just suddenly appear in whole cloth in front of us. They come from somewhere. They come from a background. And because of that, when we're listening to them, we're not just listening to what's going on now. We're listening to what happened then and now, and even things that they're anticipating, how they anticipate the future. And so part of listening is realizing I'm dealing with a whole person that has a history here. And this can be really difficult, I think, when you try to listen to someone. It can be really difficult if you don't at least have in your mind a kind of mental map that what you're hearing as you're listening to them, you're hearing about how they're built, and you're hearing about how they're bent. How they're built and how they're bent. And you're also hearing about what they're currently experiencing and how this person that's built and bent this way tends to process the things that they're hearing. I know this sounds really very complex at this point and maybe could even make you feel like you couldn't possibly ever succeed, but truthfully there's just a few things that we have to keep in mind as we're listening to someone that at least will help us listen to more than just what's in front of us right at the moment. So, for instance, the person listening to you, they're formed through biology, their genetics, their epigenetics, their biological development, sort of made them, at least in part, into the person that they are. They have a certain personality because of biology, and they have a certain predilections, you know, toward aggression or toward anxiety or toward analytic, toward observational tendencies, toward action-oriented tendencies. They're kind of just built into who they are. You know, we around here we talk about temperament. And when we talk about temperament, we're talking about how someone's put together biologically, by and large. This temperament, of course, is also affected by what happens to us developmentally in terms of our psychological development, because we're not just biological machines. We have a psychology. We have a way of seeing the world that's affected by how we were nurtured, affected by the models we saw around us. The things that were affected us that we experienced, and things, traumatic things and losses that happened, and good things and nurturing things that happened. And so our biology, together with what we've experienced psychologically, together with what's happened to us spiritually, I mean, we're also fallen, right? We're full of pride. We want our will to be done. We don't trust anyone else to take care of us. We only trust ourselves to take care of us if we trust anyone at all. We are by nature rebellious, and we are self-serving and self-seeking. This is part of us being fallen, and there's an enemy that plays against this part of what we're like. And if we were redeemed young, then we've had God's Spirit on us, and He's also been influencing us. But taken all together, we come out of our childhood with certain core beliefs, things that we deeply believe about ourselves, about others, about the world in general, about God perhaps. Things that we profoundly desire that are often connected to those beliefs, and strategies we develop sometimes before we were even cognitive in our ability to read, or even before our reasoning ability developed. I mean, we don't fully develop in our cognitive abilities and our ability to concentrate and plan and inhibit ourselves. These things don't really fully develop until we're in our early 20s. And so a lot of what's happened to us developmentally has happened before those parts of our brain are even in place. And so we come out of our youth with certain things that we've come to believe and certain things that we want and certain strategies. So just to use myself as an example to try and make this more real, you know, I've got a certain personality. I'm not going to go into that so much. But I also had a certain developmental experience, and the developmental experiences that I had, among the many positive things, there was kind of a negative streak, and that is that I had a mother who used shame as a discipline tool and who didn't really have a very strong sense of personal boundaries. And so there were a lot of things good about her, but when she didn't want me to eat sloppy at the table, she would be very angry, and she would take my plate and put it on the floor and make me eat it with my face the way a dog would eat out of a dog bowl, because she said, if you're going to eat like a dog, you're going to eat like a dog. And then she would laugh as that was happening. She did things like that to me and to my brothers. And, you know, I had chicken pox at one point, and I had a really big chicken pox scar very low in my abdomen, and she decided to pull my pajamas down in front of the neighbor to show this chicken pox scar, no sense of boundaries. And so, you know, I have a speech impediment, and some friend of hers was quietly asking her about it, apparently, in the kitchen, and my mom said loudly, I'm sure it was for my benefit, he can talk fine, he just needs to open his mouth. And now she said this not only in front of this woman, but in front of this woman's daughters who were my age and my brothers, and I just felt like I wanted to die, right? A sense of there's always the danger of being humiliated. There's always the danger of being shamed. And while there were many things that were good, I ended up coming out of my childhood with a sense, not that my mom was mean or that she wasn't very wise in her discipline. That came later. What came out of my childhood with is what every child comes out of these experiences with, the sense that there's something wrong with them. The core belief then would be that there's something about me that if people knew would be shameful to me. I felt shameful, core belief. What was a core desire I had? Well, frankly, it wasn't that sophisticated. My core desire was to never be shamed. And sometimes I might fantasize about being considered great, but most of the time it was just I needed to avoid feeling shame. And so I had all these strategies developed. One strategy was don't be around people because people are shame producers. The more you're around them, the more they see, the more they're going to comment, the more shame you're going to feel. Stay away from people. Another strategy I learned was if you have to be around people, only be noticeable in areas where you're good and strong and do not participate in things where you're weak, because failure, of course, taking risks is terrible to someone who feels shame in their core, because a risk isn't a chance to grow, a risk is a chance to feel shame. And so avoiding risks, only doing things that I was strong at, hiding, lying, concealing, being super defensive if it appeared like critique was coming in my way, justifying myself. These are all strategies I developed very young and came into my adulthood with, even as a believer. They have had a huge effect. Well, now imagine someone like me who comes from that background is talking with someone like you. How easy is it going to be for you to get at my inner life? Because the goal of listening is to get at my inner life. Well, what's in the inner life? Well, the inner life includes things that I've experienced. The inner life includes things that I feel. The inner life includes things that I'm thinking. The inner life includes things that I want and things that I've done. So how easy is it going to be for you as a listener to actually find out what's going on inside of me, what I've experienced, what I feel, what I'm thinking, what I want, and what I've done? If I walk around feeling like I'm shameful and to know me is to be shamed, it's going to be very difficult. You're going to not get the real me when you're listening to me. It's going to be hard for you to find your way to the real me. And this is what I mean when I say that when you're talking with someone, you're dealing with their past as well as their present. And one thing that's helpful if you've decided to become a good listener is that when you become a good listener, you actually create an environment that makes it most likely that someone's going to be honest about their inner life. That is, you're humble, and as you practice listening skills, you're going to provide what's really a very rare environment for someone to feel heard and listened to and feel safe enough to talk. Our core beliefs, desires, and strategies drive much of what goes on in our inner life. What do I experience when I get a call from my boss that he wants to meet with me in the morning? What's that experience? It's not data. It's not mere data. I have to make time in my schedule tomorrow. It's usually tied to a sense of something bad's about to happen. What are my thoughts? My thoughts are, what did I do wrong? And I, you know, begin developing arguments against what I think I've done wrong. And so, in these ways, you know, my inner life is very driven by this core. Of course, as someone who's grown in Christ, I don't live in this core day by day. I spend less time here. I go here less often. It's not so confusing for me to find my way out. Part of sanctification is we begin living from a different truth, a different reality. But because this is part of my flesh, it's always easy for me to go there and easy to get triggered. Right? Okay. I would like you, an exercise two, I would like you to take a look at that exercise. You'll see two parts to it. One is mapping the inner life, the Johari window. This is an exercise named after two psychologists whose first names combine to make the name Johari. I think it was, I forget what the guys' names were, John and Harrington, I think were their names. They basically had this model that a healthy person has more, the quadrant that says open is more, is larger. That is that what people know about me and what I know about myself is more the real me. The me that's out there is larger. The part of me that's hidden because of blind spots, things I don't know about myself or things others don't know about me, they should shrink as I get closer to someone. They should know more about the hidden things, and I should know more about what they see in me. And also over time, things that neither I nor they really understand about me, that should get smaller too. So your job here is just to jot down a few things that are true in each of the quadrants. So it'd be easy for you to jot down the stuff on the left, right? Because this is stuff you know that other people may or may not know. The stuff in the other quadrant, like the blind spot area, just jot down one or two things that someone has told you you didn't realize about yourself. And then the other area where neither you nor they know what's going on, you may not be able to write anything down. I could write something down, although for me it's not part of the hidden area anymore. And that shame thing would be an example of that. But prior to understanding this, I could have written down questions or things I see about myself that may lead me to that hidden area, like, why do I avoid people? Why am I so defensive? Why do I tend to hide my failures from other people? Behaviors I didn't actually like about myself, but I didn't understand where they were coming from. Those would be something you could jot down there. At least would be a way into that part of you. And I want you and your partner to just talk amongst yourselves about that. And the other part, understanding beliefs and desires, is related to what I've been talking about. And what I'd like you to do here is just to write down especially strong feelings that you have, inordinate feelings that you've had, and what happened when you felt that way. Like strong feelings would be anger, anxiety, a sense of devastation, like you wish life wouldn't go on. Very strong feelings. I just write down the feeling, write down what happened, the trigger that you felt that way. What were you thinking? And what is it you did? And if you're not going to have time to do this, but ultimately you would want to ask yourself, if I see this pattern a lot, what does it suggest that I believe? What does it suggest that I want? And maybe even, what strategies did I develop a long time ago to avoid the negative feeling and get the positive goal? So as much as you can, do jot that down. I'd just like you to get used to talking with each other about these deeper things. So go ahead and do that. Listening involves making it easy for another person to tell their story. We've learned a little bit about bias and the need for humility. We've learned a little bit about the goal of listening is to move toward intimacy and what intimacy looks like. But I'm taking this concept of turning towards someone from John Gottman's book, The Relationship Cure. In that book, Gottman has a fairly simple model that I really like. He says that when two people are interacting, one person offers what he calls a bid. A bid could be laughing at a joke, and you say, what? Right? They bid by laughing. You turn toward them by asking what. Someone says, you're really making me mad, and you say, what happened? Right? You turn toward, they bid, I'm angry, and you turn toward them by asking what happened. All right? And so he indicates then that good communication in couples that are successful couples and people who are successful with each other at listening, the tendency is to have clear bids, not fuzzy bids, and to turn toward the bid rather than, as he says, turn away from the bid or turn against the bid. What does it mean to turn away from the bid? Turning away from a bid means someone makes a bid and you say nothing. Or someone turns away from the bid and you change the subject, or offers a bid rather, and you change the subject. That's another turning away. Say nothing or changing the subject, turning away. And I think I've seen that tendency in myself in general. It doesn't have to be motivated by bad motives. It can be. When it's motivated by bad motives, we call it stonewalling or ignoring. But it can be motivated by completely neutral motives too, like I can't hear in the range of women's voices. So if a woman's talking to me, I might turn away from her bid because I didn't hear it. Or, you know, a lot of times people will begin conversations in other rooms and they'll walk into the room you're in and they're already halfway through a bid and you didn't even hear the bid. So you might turn away. Or you might go looking for someone because you want to say something to them and you're afraid to forget what you're about to say. And as soon as they see you, they start talking. And you're so afraid of losing what you're thinking that you follow their bid now with changing the subject. You say what you came to talk with them about. Now you've changed the subject. So it doesn't have to be malicious. Turning away doesn't have to be malicious. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. It can be something you do too just because you're angry and you don't know how to express your anger. Turning against a bid can mean that you are argumentative or you're defensive or sarcastic or you say counterpunch things. So to turn against means, you know, just like turning away, you're not making it easy for the person to tell their story. You are fighting with them. You're being defensive and toward them. So turning against doesn't have to be driven by negative emotions. Sometimes Gottman gives the example that we turn against when we offer advice. Are we saying there's no room for advice in a relationship? Absolutely not. There is room for advice. But when it comes to listening, if the first thing out of your mouth when someone begins to talk, sometimes even before they've been able to fully say what's on their mind, if your first response is to advise, you are turning against. You're not turning toward. And my tendency is to turn away. If I'm going to make a mistake here, my tendency is to turn away unless there is criticism coming at me, and then my tendency is to turn against. And so I find that if criticism's coming at me, I have to work doubly hard to make it easy for the person to talk, because what I want to do is to turn against them and prevent them from saying anything that's going to make me feel ashamed of myself. And so it can be hard work, but this model really helps you to sort of make decisions. What am I going to do now? Am I going to make it easy or hard for them to talk? And a good listener turns toward the other person. So I was, a while back, I had said to my wife, I was worried about my mother. She was sick. She was in the hospital. She had several rounds of illness. And I was worried about her. And I said to my wife, you know, I'm kind of worried about my mom. And before I could say anything more, she said, well, you know what you need to do about that. And I thought to myself, talk with someone else. And I realized the moment that thought came into my head was, A, this is not good that I'm thinking this way. But B, what I realized was that that my wife was not a great listener. Now, the odd thing is that I can't tell you, after our long marriage, and it's been a great marriage, I can't actually tell you that I had that clear thought ever before. It wasn't until that moment of emotional anxiety that I saw something that was probably present all along. And so I said, you know, you're not really a very good listener. And for a period of time, she would let me know that you know, you say, I'm not a good listener, you're not a good listener. And truthfully, there's probably a lot there she could go after. Initially, I think she was defensive. I guess I'm seeing it as defensive. Even if she was accurate, that maybe I'm not a great listener. And as I, you know, as time went on, I began realizing, okay, this, it was helpful for me to realize this isn't personal. This isn't that she doesn't love me. It's not that she doesn't care about me. It's just not a strong skill. Temperamentally, it's not a strong skill. And when I stopped taking it personally, I stopped feeling like it was about her not caring. It was actually much easier for me to be able to say, I just need you to hear me out, when she would, you know, respond to a bid by turning against with helpful advice. And over time, she also seemed to feel like this was an area she wanted to work on. And so if I said, I just want you to hear me out, she would say, all right, try it again. And so, you know, between me noticing she wasn't good at listening, she tended to turn against in a helpful way, in an effort to be helpful. And me saying that, not taking it personally, we're able to kind of navigate toward really a better relationship, I think, even though I've thoroughly enjoyed my relationship. It's gotten better since then. And I know that my tendency to turn against when she's coming after me has needed some very careful attention. I make it painful to criticize me. And I had to come to realize that this defensiveness was not helping her and it wasn't helping me. So I think we both have the ability, equal ability to turn away when we're focused on something else. But if I realized I've turned away, then just to be able to say, I'm sorry, say that again. I didn't hear what you said, or I wasn't paying attention. So this habit of learning how to turn towards someone, really important. And to sort of begin recognizing your tendencies in turning away or turning against, super important. And not taking it personally, also very, very important. So how do you turn towards someone? Well, you know, the context for me talking about this is you turn towards someone when they make a bid. But you can also turn towards someone when they don't make a bid. You can turn towards someone when you just notice things. So one way of turning towards someone is just to notice out loud. I don't know if you realize what this is. You're telling someone what you're experiencing when you notice out loud things you see. That is, you're being intimate with them, right? Intimacy is, I see what I experience, how I feel about it, what I'm thinking, what I want, what I did. If that's intimacy, then part of me turning towards someone is I just notice out loud to them what I've experienced. You seem angry. Are you angry? You seem anxious about something. Are you feeling anxious? You seem pensive, like you were thinking about something. Is there something you're thinking about? In these kinds of ways, noticing out loud is a way of, I guess it's a way into listening. It's a doorway you can open and then create an environment where someone can start talking and you can listen. And so I kind of learned a little bit about this from my office mate, Dan Walker. Years ago, we had neighbors that my wife and I had been inviting out to our central teaching, and they kept saying yes, and they kept not showing up, right? So what am I experiencing? I'm experiencing a yes, and I'm experiencing a no-show. And so, unfortunately, I'd drawn a conclusion. What that means is they're not really interested. So I was going over there one night to retrieve some tools, and my wife said, hey, you know, make sure you ask them to come to CT. And I thought, I'm not going to ask them to come to CT. And I went over there, and they weren't home, so I came back home. And the next day I was talking to Dan Walker, my office mate, and said, you know, my wife keeps, you know, pestering me to invite them out to Central Teaching, but they're obviously not interested because they're not showing up. I was trying to recruit him to my conclusion. And he said, do you think they would like it? I'm like, yeah, I think they'd like it. What are you concerned about? Well, I don't want to pester them. He said, why don't you just say those two things, right? he was saying to me, be intimate with your neighbors. And so in being intimate, then it would open up the door to me being able to listen. So I went over there the next night to get my tools, and I said, so I was going to invite you out to see tea, but I'm afraid I'm pestering you, although I do think you'd like, I think you'd like this the situation. And the wife says, oh, you're not pestering us. And then the husband said, well, what clothing should I wear? Can I wear what I'm wearing now? And he said, is there going to be music? Is there going to be singing? And I'd drawn a completely wrong conclusion. It was obvious to me they weren't interested, but I was obviously wrong. What was going on was that they weren't, they were saying they were interested in not coming out because they didn't know what to expect. So once I explained to them what to expect, they came out and eventually became believers. And so this isn't listening directly, is it? It's I did end up listening to them, but I had to kind of break the ice by being intimate with them, by sharing with them what I was thinking and what I was feeling and what I wanted. And in doing that, then it created an environment where they could be, they could talk to me and I could listen. So notice this is really actually quite powerful. To notice things out loud and ask. Instead of noticing things out loud and concluding, noticing out loud what you see and asking about it. Help me understand what's going on. This is what I'm seeing. I don't get it. Help me understand it. Very, very powerful way toward a listening opportunity. Or if someone makes a bid in the way that we've been talking, let them have their turn first. Even if their bid is hostile toward you, make it easy for them to talk. Even if their bid is somehow opposing what it is you want, make it easy for them to talk. Even if their bid is critical, make it easy for them to talk. And so my wife's mother has gone from her home to the hospital to a nursing home. And as soon as she went into the hospital, my wife went up there that following weekend to be with her. It was the same weekend, was a weekend when we were supposed, our family was involved in her family, a wedding in her family, but not in the same city. So her mom's in Cleveland, we're in Columbus, the wedding's going to be in Marblehead. And so my wife's in Cleveland, I'm in Columbus, I come up to the Marblehead with my daughter, my wife comes over from Cleveland, we do the wedding, I was officiating, and then my wife goes back to Cleveland, and I take my daughter back to Columbus, and then my wife comes back home, Debbie comes back home, and when she comes home, my daughter's tied up doing something. She might not even have been home, I'm not sure. I was trying to put a meal together and get some dishes cleaned up, so when my wife came in, I didn't really acknowledge her much. I kind of looked over my shoulder at her, but it wasn't a warm greeting. I was trying to function, get something done. And a few days later, she said with, tearfully, she said, I feel like I've got something I want to say to you. It's going to be hard. I hope you'll listen to me. And internally, of course, given my background, I want to defend myself. I'm about to be told that I failed somehow. And I want to defend myself, but I've lived long enough with this idea that I thought to myself, you've got plenty of time to respond to what she said, make it easy for her to talk. And so she said, you didn't offer to come to Cleveland after the wedding, which was true. It didn't even really cross my mind. I just wanted to get back home because I had work the next day. When I came home, you didn't greet me. I feel like I'm in this alone. And there's a part of me, the defensive part of me, that's arguing against her conclusion, her feelings that she's in this alone. And I had reasons evidence began to be marshaled in my mind why she was wrong in her conclusion. But again, I sort of committed myself. I wanted to make it easy for her to talk, and so I fed back what I thought she was saying. And this is part of what I'm asking you to do, is to learn how to reflect back, to say back what you've heard, to summarize what you've heard, which is what I was doing, to validate. Now, this is really important. Validation means that you say to someone, because you've listened long enough that you get why they would feel the way they feel, or why they might have done what they did, you say, it makes sense to me that you feel that way. And I can validate someone who has a feeling I don't feel like is a good feeling to have, because I've listened long enough that I get why they're angry or get why they're hurt. And I can also validate someone who has a feeling that I think is totally justified. And so I could say to her, I could validate her and say, I can see why you would feel like you were on your own. It didn't cross my mind to go with you. So I'm validating her. And I'm also agreeing with her that I screwed up. And those other things that I didn't feel like were fair. She had an example where she thought I had let my brothers handle my mother's affairs and left them doing all the work and I didn't do anything. I didn't think that was fair, but I didn't bring that up because my goal is to listen, right? But there's a point at which I could still say, I can still validate the feeling. It makes sense that you would feel like I'm not built to be very responsive to things like this, that I'm not going to be helpful. I can see why you'd feel that way. In that case, I didn't really agree that I wasn't going to be helpful or that I had no helpful bones in my body. I just got why she would have felt that way, right? So in that case, I'm validating without necessarily agreeing. It would make sense in light of the fact that I'd done really nothing to support her emotionally. I think at one point she was talking to me on the phone and I was watching the news. And in watching the news, I had it on mute and I was looking at subtitles and I was talking with her on the phone. She's upset and I'm really kind of detached in my come off because I'm trying to finish this news story. And so, you know, of course she's going to feel like she's on her own. Even if, you know, the whole picture taken together, I don't want her to be on her own and I want to be supportive. But at that moment, I wasn't being supportive. So validating, summarizing, validating, very important. Another way to think about validating is leaning out on the rail with them. I take this analogy from, you know, when a sailboat's sailing and it begins to tip over, the natural tendency is to go to the opposite rail and to lean out. Similarly, when someone is very emotional and negative about something, the tendency is to go on the other rail and lean out. That is to say the opposite of what they're saying. You know, if they say this whole thing's blowing up, then we say, no, it's not blowing up. If they say, I'm never going to experience this, you say, well, that's not true. It's not true you're never going to experience this, right? We lean out on the other rail. One time someone came to me, And, of course, leaning out on the other rail is not validating. And it's not listening. It's not good listening. So a guy came to me one time and said, I'm ending my cell group. And I internally, because I love stability, I'm like, I've got to block this guy from doing this. This is going to be a disaster. And so I want to go out on the other rail and lean out. But instead I said, why do you want to do that? Right now I'm out on the rail with him. And he's saying, my co-leader left. He went off to do this other ministry. He didn't even talk with me. He just announced it. He left me with all these really passive guys. They don't prepare. They show up unready. And I'm sitting on the rail with him. I kind of lean it out a little bit. And I'm like, that would be a drag to be stuck with a bunch of guys who are passive and not participating. I could see why you want to end the group. I'm validating. And the more he's listened to and the more he's validated, the calmer he got. And I was able to say after a few beats, after listening, summarizing, I said, the only thing that concerns me about your plan, this guy was choleric, and so he usually leads with his plans. But you know, someone who's choleric will lead with a plan, and their plan is an invitation for you to talk. And if you're not built that way, you think their plan is set in stone, they're going to do it, and all you can do is get out of the way. It's not true. In this case, he presented me with his plan, and I said, you know, the thing that worries me about this is the message you're going to give, especially since you're going from, you know, normal cell group to ending the cell group one night. The message you're going to give is that they do not matter. And is that really the message you want to give? Or that they're just a giant pain in your butt? Is that really the message you want to give? In the end, he didn't end the group. And he came up with another solution that was a good solution, I thought. But the point is, I could have leaned out on the other rail, and he would have begun saying things that were more extreme than even he believed, just because he wasn't feeling heard. When people don't feel heard, they start talking in extreme ways. All right. So the next exercise I want you to do is I'd like you to tell each other, take turns, and I'd like you to tell the other person about something that happened to you this week, positive or negative. And if you're the listener, I want you to just not say a word, no words, because I want you to realize how often you like to talk, but also say no words so that you can practice learning how to communicate "I'm listening" just by the use of your body language. So go ahead and do that. All right, this is a real brief break, and what I want you to do now is I want you to say back what you heard the other person say, summarize what you heard them say, and as much as possible, validate what they've said. So this time, you're recalling your previous conversation, summarizing it, validating it. And if you don't remember what they said, then you just need to say, "I'm really embarrassed, but I don't remember what you said. Could you say it again?" And then summarize and validate. Go ahead and do that. All right, so at this point, our time is short, but I want to talk about what it looks like to get around people's bad habits. When people are offensive or they're defensive, rather than being intimate, that is, they're not saying what they're experiencing, how they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they want, what they did. Instead, they're being offensive, they're attacking, or they're being defensive. It can be really tempting to argue with them about the things that they're saying that are offensive or defensive. But it's much better to guide the conversation back toward understanding what's going on in their inner life and letting them know what's going on in yours. So for instance, if intimacy is saying what I experience and saying how I feel and saying what I think and what I want and what I've done, a lot of times in conversations, people have habits, bad habits, that don't lead to them sharing this stuff. It leads to them instead presenting not their experiences, but how they've interpreted those experiences. You know, for instance, maybe you changed the subject. They were saying A and you said B. Or maybe they were being really strong and negative about something and you went out and said the opposite because you're leaning on the opposite rail. And whatever the experience was, they concluded from that you obviously don't care what they think or how they feel. So now they're interpreting it. They had an experience, right? You changed the subject or you were pressing against their conclusions, and that was the experience they had, but then they concluded you don't care enough about them. And so they throw that interpretation, "You obviously don't care about me." And it can be really tempting to start arguing about their conclusion. Is it true I don't care about you? That's not true. Let me give you all the evidence why I do care. Or instead of someone saying how they feel, they blame you for how they feel. "You make me mad. You make me sad. You did this and left me feeling." So all this kind of language communicates that somehow my emotional life was caused by your behavior. Instead of saying what they're thinking, they'll insist that their thoughts are true. You know, if we're going to be humble, we have to be tentative about our thoughts, whether they're true or false. But they're insisting their thoughts are true, or they're not just saying what they want, they feel entitled to what they want. Someone who's entitled either demands or feels self-pity because not just that they want X, but they feel like they deserve X. And so their entitlement comes out, or instead of saying what they did, they justify what they did. A lot of times I don't say what I do if I feel like I'm going to get criticized for it. I'll spend most of my lead time talking about all the circumstances that led up to the thing I haven't yet admitted I've done. I'm justifying before I'm even confessing. And so if someone does that, how do you succeed? How do you make progress with them? Well, I think what you need to realize is your goal is to keep being intimate yourself, and your goal is to get them back toward their intimate life, toward their inner life. And so what you can do is not bite on these hooks, not bite on the interpretations and the blame and the entitlement and the justification, not start arguing about these things, but instead use these things as a chance to get back to what happened. What did they experience? How did they feel? What were they thinking? What did they want? What did they do? So if someone interprets or mind reads me, I could fight with them, I suppose, about their interpretation. You obviously don't care about me. You obviously have no respect for me. I could bite on that and say, that's not true. What about this time when I did show respect for you? And I could argue with them, but it's a dead end. It's a non-starter. It's better for me to say, wow, I don't want you to feel that way. What happened that left you feeling that way? What am I doing? I'm taking their interpretation and using it as a chance to talk with them about what they've experienced. And then from there, how they felt about it and what it is they wanted and maybe some of the thoughts they had. I've got plenty of time to go back later and say, you know, your conclusion that I didn't care about you, I don't think was fair. I mean, I get what you experienced because we've talked about it, but it wasn't actually what I was thinking. Would you be willing to hear what I think I was thinking? Right? See how tentative even that is? I'm not completely confident my own account of myself is accurate. Right? Humility. Someone blames you for how they feel, just ask, don't bite on whether it's your responsibility that they feel that way or not, or don't fight with them about the concept of whether someone can be blamed for someone else's feelings. Just say, wow, what happened that you felt that way? And then ask them about, so when that happened, you were feeling this. Wow. Validate, summarize, turn toward, right? When someone insists that their thoughts are reality, sometimes this can be really extreme. I've given you a handout that's entitled ANTS, ANTS, Automatic Negative Thoughts. The first half of the sheet describes if you're someone who has automatic negative thoughts, ways you can find your way out of that morass. And the second half of the sheet talks about if you're interacting with someone who has an automatic, in other words, if their thoughts are very extreme, how you can help them walk back from that. It's complicated enough that I would just encourage you to take a look at that. If someone is telling you that their thoughts are reality, just ask them questions about what they're thinking. Don't ask them about whether it's, don't get into arguments about whether their thoughts are valid or not. Just ask them about their thoughts. When someone feels entitled to what they want, you can just go back and ask them more about what they wanted it and why. Why did you want that? I could see why you would want that, right? Summarize, validate, turn toward. If someone is justifying their behaviors, you could fight with them about whether their behavior is justified, or you could just ask them more, so what did you do? And what were you thinking that you did that? And how were you feeling? And often as we turn toward someone and they begin exposing what's going on in their inner life, they'll repent. We don't have to say much. You know, there are other offensive or defensive behaviors people have. I've given you a sheet on defensiveness and some homework to do on that. I'm hoping that'll help you a little bit. But I hope you realize that the goal when someone's being offensive or defensive is to be open with what's going on in your inner life. Wow, this is confusing to me, or I'm really bothered that you feel that way, or I feel sad when I hear that, or I don't understand that. Help me understand that. And by being intimate myself and by inviting them to be intimate, we can often find a way around these bad habits they have of communicating. These bad habits come from long ago, and they didn't start with you, and they're not going to probably end with you, but you can open up other ways out of this conversation other than battling. You may be wondering, when does Scripture come in? And this is really a workshop on listening. That means it's biased and limited in some ways. But I would say that, when should a doctor prescribe medicine? What surgical procedure should a surgeon do? Well, it depends on what they find, right? You have to do a diagnosis before you can provide a solution. And I think Scripture's very important, especially when you begin understanding what the issue is they're dealing with. And listening is a way to get you to the point that you might at least get a better sense of what truth they need to understand. Our problem is a lot of times we provide, we open up the pharmacy chest and start throwing medicine that is Scripture references to people before we even know what's wrong. So I don't want you to think listening means you never have to bring truth in or even rebuke. Listening doesn't mean that. It does mean your truth and your rebuke is going to be more powerful because you have first listened.